From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with actor Edward Norton. He played a murderer with a dual personality in Primal Fear, a skinhead in American History X, and a wimp turned fighter in Fight Club. Now he's starring opposite Robert De Niro and Marlon Brando in the new film The Score. Later, Henry Sheehan will review The Score. Sidney Poitier's memoir has just come out in paperback. We'll talk with him about some of his early films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The International Olympic Committee has awarded the 2008 Summer Olympic Games to Beijing. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Although four other cities, Paris, Toronto, Osaka, and Istanbul, competed for the 2008 Games, in the end there was really no contest. With more than 100 IOC members voting, Beijing took nearly a majority of the votes on the first round and won solidly with 56 votes on the second. China has never hosted the Games. 8 years ago, Beijing bid for the 2000 Games and lost out to Sydney. Many members of the IOC expressed satisfaction with the choice, praising China for how far it has reformed its economy, but warning the whole world will be watching how it handles the issue of human rights. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, a ceremonial member of the IOC, said this was an important step in China's opening itself up to the world. The IOC's work is not done. On Monday, it elects a successor to Juan Antonio Samaranch, who retires after 21 years as IOC president. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Moscow.
President Bush said today his administration will invest tens of millions of dollars to look into ways to fight global warming. The announcement comes just days before an international conference on the Kyoto Pact on global climate change. President Bush has rejected that agreement. The president's statement says that NASA will invest more than $120 million over the next 3 years in research on the natural carbon cycle, climate modeling, and the link between atmospheric chemistry and climate. Efforts by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights to reform election law were bogged down today by recriminations over last fall's election in Florida. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The goal of the commission was to get beyond the bitterness over what happened in Florida and offer suggestions on how to make sure it doesn't happen anywhere again. But the commissioners spent most of the 3.5-hour meeting bickering, complaining about each other's bitter tone in newspaper articles and reports, and blaming each other for leaks to the media. The commission had already released its findings about Florida's election irregularities last month. It concluded that thousands of people were turned away at the polls because of a series of election errors. The two Republican commissioners on the 8-member panel did not agree with those conclusions, and the resulting rancor forced them to delay their recommendations until their next meeting 2 months from now. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
California Congressman Gary Condit has taken a lie detector test arranged by his lawyer. Condit's attorney, Abby Lowell, says the test showed Condit was not deceptive in any way in the investigation into the disappearance of Chandra Levy. But a Washington, D.C. police official calls the test self-serving. Assistant Police Chief Terrence Gaynor says Lowell did not work with police to come up with the questions and agree on an expert to administer the test. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 60 points today to close at 10,539, and the Nasdaq was down 3 at 2072. This is NPR. A federal jury in Manhattan has convicted a third Algerian national of taking part in a terrorism plot to bomb the Los Angeles International Airport during the 1999 Millennium Celebration. From member station WNYC, Amy Eddings has the latest.
After 2 days of deliberations, the jury found Mokhtar Hawadi guilty of two of the three charges against him, providing support to terrorists and trafficking in false documents. He faces up to 100 years in prison. The government's case rested heavily on his two co-conspirators, Ahmed Rassam and Abdel Ghani Miskini, who cooperated with prosecutors. Hawadi gave money to Rassam and enlisted the help of Miskini, who was to meet Rassam in Seattle and give him money and a fake driver's license. But the plot was foiled when Rassam was arrested trying to enter the United States from Vancouver with a car carrying explosives. Prosecutors believe the three defendants and a fourth, who is being held in Algeria, are part of a network of Algerian militants who operated in Canada. For NPR News, I'm Amy Eddings in New York.
The Justice Department said today that President Bush's choice to head the FBI has prostate cancer. Doctors say they expect Robert Mueller to make a full recovery. White House officials say President Bush is convinced the cancer was caught early and would not hinder Mueller's ability to serve as FBI director. U.S. and North Korean negotiators tried again today to reach agreement on a plan for comprehensive new negotiations. The 90-minute meeting in New York was the latest in a number of working-level contacts in recent months. The Bush administration announced last month that it was willing to resume talks with North Korea on a comprehensive package of issues, including its missile program and its heavy concentration of troops and weaponry along the border with South Korea. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, The Score, starring Robert De Niro, Edward Norton, and Marlon Brando, opened today. Later in the show, film critic Henry Sheehan will have a review. But first, we're going to hear an interview with Edward Norton. In The Score, De Niro plays a jewel thief looking to retire, who's convinced to do one last heist by his partner, played by Marlon Brando. Edward Norton plays the young, arrogant new member of the team. Here he is meeting a couple of guys in the park. He's brought a bag of money to exchange for some inside information.
You my guy?
Yeah. Who's this?
Cousin.
Cousin? Okay. See the guy over my left shoulder back there on the bench reading the paper? The big one? That's my cousin. Okay? So we've all got family here, which is nice, I think. Yeah? Okay. I'll give you that. Take a look inside and make sure you're happy, all right? No, don't take that out. Don't take that out.
Hey, man. Don't give me orders. I get orders all day, okay?
Can't count the money in a public place. That's why you don't set a meeting in a park. Just for future reference.
Edward Norton had no trouble getting noticed when he started making movies. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his feature film debut in Primal Fear, in which he played an altar boy on trial for murder. Then Woody Allen cast him in the musical Everyone Says I Love You. Norton played Larry Flint's lawyer in The People vs. Larry Flint and received another Academy Award nomination for his role as a skinhead in American History X. He co-starred with Brad Pitt in Fight Club and with Ben Stiller in Keeping the Faith. I spoke with Norton last year. Let me ask you about your first movie role, which was Primal Fear. In fact, let me play a clip from it. In this, you play a former altar boy named Aaron who's from a small town in Kentucky. You're accused of brutally murdering a cardinal. Your lawyer is played by Richard Gere. Now, you claim to suffer from amnesiac blackouts, and a psychiatrist hired by your lawyer thinks that that's a symptom of multiple personality disorder. In this scene, after your lawyer tells you that he thinks you're really guilty, your other personality, Roy, comes to the surface. This is the first time your lawyer has seen evidence of a split personality.
You're a lawyer. You was lawyer, ain't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, with your fancy suit. I heard about you. Well, my, my. You sure f*** this one up, counselor. It sounds to me like they're gonna shoot old Aaron so full of poison it's gonna come out his eyes.
Where is Aaron?
Aaron's crying off in some corner somewhere. You scared him off. You gotta deal with me now, boy. I'll give you a beating on principle. Look at me. You ever come in here pulling that tough guy shit on Aaron again, I will kick your ass to Sunday. Do you understand me?
I understand you. I understand. Aaron gets in trouble, he calls you. You're the man.
Well, Aaron couldn't kick his own ass. I mean, you seen him with the
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, he can't handle anything. Now, he sure as shit couldn't handle all that preacher's blood, could he? If he'd have done like I told him, we wouldn't be in this mess. But he got scared and ran off, got himself caught, the stupid little shit.
So Aaron did kill Rushman.
What? Hell no! Jesus Christ, where'd they find you? Ain't you been listening to me? Aaron don't have the guts to do nothing. It was me, boy. It was me.
It was you.
Yes, it was.
It was you.
That's Edward Norton and Richard Gere in a scene from Primal Fear. So this was your first movie role, a big part. How did you get it? How did you get such a good part the first time out?
I don't know. That was weird listening to that for me, because I don't think I've watched that movie since the week it came out, which was about 4 years ago. And I was listening to those lines. I haven't even thought about them for a bunch of years. I was listening to it like I didn't even remember that's what that scene was about. It was wild. I just haven't revisited that in a long time.
You have a foul mouth, sir.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The guy. He's a tough character, but that was very interesting. We improvised a lot in those scenes, so a lot of that was just stuff that kind of, you know, we kind of riffed around the basic components of the scene, and Richard was really good at that, so it was fun to do.
So how did you get the part?
Well, it was a situation where they, obviously by its nature, it's a role that has to do with first impressions and deceptions and kind of acting within acting. And I think that wisely, Greg Hoblit was aware that it was something that if the audience could actually be fooled in the same way that the lawyer is being fooled, it would be very effective, as opposed to, you know, if it was an actor that people were familiar with and so they were aware of the artifice on some level from the beginning, that could kind of diminish it. And I think he was very intent on trying to find someone who was unfamiliar to audiences, and so as a result they engaged in a, you know, in an audition search, and so it was a very unusual circumstance of a very, very good part where they were really looking around, and they went all over the place, and I was obviously acting in New York in the theater at the time, and the casting director for Paramount had seen me in some plays and brought me in among many, many others to audition for Greg, and it kind of went on from there.
Was this audition an interview, or did you have to do lines?
No. It's always if they're doing it right. I mean, I think one of the worst things that can happen in an audition is when you walk in the room and there's a director and producer and they start talking to you, because it's just like, I mean, try to imagine going to see, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Rain Man, and before the movie starts, a little thing comes up on the screen, and Dustin Hoffman says, "Hi, I'm Dustin Hoffman, and I'm about to play this role, and I hope you all enjoy the film." And then you watched him play that character. It's like it just punctures.
Absolutely.
It punctures the bubble. And I think I've always said, whenever I've gone to classes or you know, to places where younger actors want to ask questions and things like that, one of the things I've always said is, don't let them do that to you. You know, when you go into an audition, do not let them talk to you beforehand, because it's like, it's just like cutting the legs out from under everything you're about to try to do, which is to say, fool them in the same way that you're going to fool an audience, even when it's not such a deceptive character, even when it's not a character who is pulling such a trick on people, even if it's just a, you know, me playing, I don't know, you know, like any of the characters I've played in films, you don't want to walk in and talk and be yourself and then launch into this character, because it's automatically going to sort of seem more like a put-on.
What would make it even worse, I think, is that you had to do a Southern accent for this. So they hear
accent.
Your regular accent and then they go,
especially,
oh.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a theory about accents, which is that if someone, I mean, I think if you walked up to any, even if you did a bad British accent, say, if you walked up to someone and you were doing it, and that was the first time they met you, no one would question it. Whereas, you know, I could walk up to a lot of people right now and do an absolutely flawless British accent, and by virtue of the fact that they know that I'm not British, they'd be saying, oh, well, that kind of doesn't sound right to me. I think people have a very relative, their critique of things is relative to how aware they are that you're doing a put-on, you know. And I think when actors have to do a accent or anything like that, if you have to go into an audition, it's the worst thing in the world is to have to talk to the people beforehand and then launch into this, you know, because they're going to, in their minds, they're going to go, I don't think he's doing that well, you know.
Fight Club is a movie about people who find meaning in life by joining this very secret club in which they fight each other quite hard. I'm going to play a clip from early in the movie where all we really know about your character is that he's a young guy who's just really disenchanted with the life he's found himself leading, worrying about shopping for the right bedspread and the right coffee. And he's a numbers cruncher for a car maker. and he's become an insomniac. So he tries to find peace of mind by attending support groups for problems he doesn't even have. His job requires him to do a lot of traveling, you know, by plane. And this is him thinking about all the travel and all the trivialities and mind-numbing stuff that it leads to.
You wake up at SeaTac, SFO, LAX. You wake up at O'Hare, Dallas-Fort Worth, BWI, Pacific, Mountain, Central. Lose an hour, gain an hour.
Check-in for that flight doesn't begin for another 2 hours, sir.
This is your life, and it's ending 1 minute at a time. You wake up at Air Harbor International. If you wake up at a different time, in a different place, could you wake up as a different person? Everywhere I travel, tiny life, single serving sugar, single serving cream, single pat of butter, the microwave cordon bleu hobby kit, shampoo conditioner combos, sample packaged mouthwash, tiny bars of soap. The people I meet on each flight, they're single serving friends. Between takeoff and landing, we have our time together, but that's all we get.
That's kind of like the urban neurotic alienated professional version of rap. Did you do that voiceover with the music or without it?
No, without it. Without it. We spent a lot of time in booths like this one working. We tried every kind of mic, close to the mic, far from the mic. We experimented just into infinity with finding exactly the right tone to create the feeling of that voice that's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So that it would have a quality distinct from sort of what we're used to hearing in voiceovers, you know, of really almost being inside the brain, that voice that you're talking to yourself with, you know. And the narration, obviously, it was such a critical component of the novel that we felt it needed to be a part of the film as well.
Is narration very hard because it's not like you're talking to somebody, and yet you have to make it really believable as that inner voice?
It is. And it has to be a characterization. Especially in the case of this film where the underlying reality, the underlying truth of the film is revealed to be something very different from what the narrator himself is presenting it as. It's a bizarre comparison in a way, but, you know, I've always thought what's great about a book like The Catcher in the Rye is that it's told in a first-person narrative by a narrator who's not a very reliable source of perspective on himself, and you learn things about Holden Caulfield that he's not really telling you about in the dialogue, in the scenes where what he's saying to people kind of goes against what he's saying to you in his inner monologue. And this reminded me of that because my character in Fight Club is a totally unreliable source of information about himself. He's telling you a version of his story that, as the story goes along, you realize is a completely diluted understanding of his own problems. And so you have to make – that has to be – the voiceover can't just be a narration. It has to be a characterization.
Which leads me to say, without giving away too much of the story, that you've played a lot of like double personalities and double roles in your career where your character undergoes some kind of transformation and is both good guy and bad guy.
Yeah.
Why do you think you've had so many roles like that?
Well, I think that any character should undergo a transformation. I mean, that to me is what drama is about. It's like I had a good acting teacher one time who said, you know, you should always be able to look at a scene and certainly a whole piece and say, you should be able to look at a drama and identify what happens that changes things in it. I mean, a story should be at its fundament, you know, something happens as a result of which something changes. And to me, if a character doesn't transform on some level in a story, it's not worth playing because I think that's why people are going to movies to plays, reading novels, because you want to read about people evolving in some way. That's what you connect with. And I think that in Fight Club, it's very different from Primal Fear in the sense that it's Primal Fear is about somebody acting, basically. Fight Club is about a person actually going insane.
Right.
And not knowing that he's going insane. And obviously I don't play both halves of his personality. I play one half, and I play the half that is learning, that comes to, has to, a guy who has to come to grips with the fact that he's crazy, and has to realize how crazy he's gone. So even though on a loose level there, it's connected with Primal Fear, it really was a very different sort of a thing. But it is, but what I liked about it is it's a character who, he changes. His sense of his own desperation in the beginning leads him to experiment with a kind of a solution that he ultimately realizes is very, very negative and very unhealthy, and from which he pulls back and finally by the end, you know, defines himself. He finally, I think on a certain level, right at the end, figures out who he is on his own.
My guest is Edward Norton. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Edward Norton. He's starring in the new movie, The Score. Let's get to another one of your movies, Everyone Says I Love You, which was Woody Allen's musical in which he had actors who really aren't singers singing songs for the film. You had two songs, Just You, Just Me, and My Baby Just Cares for Me. Let's hear a little bit of My Baby Just Cares for Me.
My baby don't care for rings or other expensive things. My baby just cares for me. My baby don't go for big Rolls Royces. There's sometimes a doubt about her choices. My baby don't care to own some 14 karat stone. She's sensible as can be. My baby don't care who knows it. My baby just cares for me.
Edward Norton, what were your thoughts when you found out you had to sing in order to be in Woody Allen's movie?
I felt much the same way I feel right now, having played that back in my ear. I feel like putting a paper bag over my head. You're officially turned this into a torture booth now that you've played my played me singing back to myself.
Did you know right at the start that singing was essential for all the players?
No, nobody knew. I remember when I met Woody for the second time, and it seemed to be going well in terms of, you know, him wanting me to do the part. Right toward the end, you know, he came over and he went, you know, I read a scene and he went, you know, that was perfect, that was great. And, you know, by the way, do you sing at all? You know, and I kind of went, what? You know, sure, you know, and not in a great way, but is the character a singer? And he went, well, you know, I'm not looking for Pavarotti. I'm just something I'm playing with, you know. And I was going, I wonder what that's about. So I got the part and I was all excited. And about a month, you know, a couple months went by, and about a month before we started shooting, I got this call from Dick Hyman, who's Woody's longtime music supervisor and arranger and kind of a genius of orchestration and arrangement. And, you know, and he said, I'm going to have you get together with a voice person in Los Angeles because we need to get your range. And I went, what is this for? And he said, well, we're making a musical. And I kind of like started hyperventilating, and apparently everyone else had pretty much the same experience, because he didn't want to give anybody any time to panic and go out and, you know, work on it. He wanted everybody to sound, the whole idea was people coming off the, you know, the characters like normal people just bursting into song with all their, you know, cracking voices and everything. He did not want a polished thing.
Nevertheless, did he want you all to take some voice lessons?
No, not at all. In fact, he insisted that we not do it. And in fact, when I went and laid down, we pre-recorded the song so that we could sing back to our, you know, lip sync to or sing along with our own playback when we filmed it. And I pre-recorded the songs, and you know, of course, I had worked on them because there was no way I was gonna go in cold, and I did it. And about a week later, I got a call, you know, and they said, "Woody wants to talk to you about what you recorded." And I just went, "Oh no, I'm getting fired," because Woody lets a lot of people go. It's kind of Woody's famous for, you know, firing people, and I thought, this is it, I'm out. And I went back in to see him, and he said, "You know, we need to do it again because you sound too good. You sound like Perry Como. You know, I need you to scale it back a little bit." So he actually made me come in and do it worse. I had a couple tracks. I had a couple tracks that I was really happy with, and he made me come in and kind of sing it more like a guy on the street, you know.
So what impact did this movie have on your own self-consciousness about singing?
I try to shut it out, and occasionally someone will do what you just did and throw on the soundtrack, and it'll all come raging back to me like a
bad dream.
No, the experience. No, I'm kidding. It's just hard to hear it, you know, disconnected. I love watching it in the film because I think the film is, you know, so light and funny, and actually that song, "My Baby Just Cares for Me," is the one in the Harry Winston's jewelry store where the whole musical number erupts in the jewelry store, and I think it's a hilarious sequence, but out of context, it's a little bit like looking at your high school yearbook pictures.
Edward Norton recorded last year. He stars with Robert De Niro and Marlon Brando in the new film The Score. Later, film critic Henry Sheehan will review The Score. We'll end this half hour with a song composed by Jimmy McHugh. His songs include "On the Sunny Side of the Street," "I'm in the Mood for Love," and "I Can't Give You Anything But Love." Monday, we'll talk with his grandson, Jim McHugh III. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and here's the Mills Brothers.
"I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness. And I guess, well, all those things you always pine for, gee, I'd like to see you looking swell, baby. Diamond bracelets, Woolworth doesn't sell, baby. Till that lucky day, I know darn well, baby. I can't give you anything but love.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've got plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, someday you'll find happiness."
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Vintage Books, a division of Random House and publishers of the new paperback novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Sidney Poitier talks about breaking into acting when his Caribbean accent was a detriment, and his early films like Blackboard Jungle and The Defiant Ones. And Henry Sheehan reviews The Score.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sidney Poitier has said that he always believed that his work should convey his personal values. When he started making movies in 1949, it was hard for African Americans to get significant film roles. It was even difficult to get small parts that weren't stereotyped. But in the 50s and 60s, Poitier starred in a string of films that addressed the racial tensions of the time. Films like The Defiant Ones, Lilies of the Field, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and To Sir with Love. In 1963, he became the first African-American to win an Academy Award for Best Actor, and he remains the only African-American who has won in that category. In the 70s, Poitier directed such films as Buck and the Preacher, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, and Stir Crazy. He's made new films since the end of the 70s. His memoir, The Measure of a Man, has just come out in paperback. Poitier grew up in the Bahamas on Cat Island and Nassau. His family was poor and he had very little education. He left for the U.S. when he was 15 and ended up in New York, where he was arrested for vagrancy and worked as a dishwasher. He saw an ad for auditions for the American Negro Theater and decided to try out. The audition was a disaster, and the director threw him out and told him to get back to being a dishwasher. Poitier was determined to prove him wrong. What did you do to try to improve your auditioning skills before going back to prove that this guy was wrong and that you could do it?
Well, my first job was to, because I had this Caribbean accent, as you, I'm sure you're acquainted with.
Let me just stop you there and say I can hear the accent much more in this interview than I hear it in movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had it very intensely and so much so that he made a remark about it, and I knew that from what he had said that I had to do something about that first and foremost. So I saved up enough money to buy a radio, and I thought that the best way to correct it was to listen to a radio here in America and try to learn the sounds, the pronunciations and stuff from people I heard on the radio. And I did that, and I listened to the radio between dishwashing, in terms of, in other words, when I'd get home, wherever I was sleeping, I would plug in this little radio and I would listen until I fell asleep. And whatever was said on the radio, I would repeat it. Like a parrot. And I would just listen and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And it took some months, and the heavy A in the Caribbean speech and the rhythmic sing-songy patterns began to fade, and I began to develop at least the rhythm and pronunciation of how people spoke in the U.S.
So you patterned yourself on radio announcers.
Yes. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman in those days by the name of Norman Brokenshire, and I listened to him. He had a very arresting voice, and I liked the way he spoke, and I listened to him an awful lot. Didn't always understood what he was saying, but I listened a great deal, and I learned... I learned pronunciation of words that I was studying. What I was trying to learn what the words meant.
So you went back to the American Negro Theater Company and auditioned a second time?
Yeah, I certainly did. That was my aim. I went back 6 months later and to audition, but I was really not really prepared because I didn't have a scene or a monologue from a play. I didn't know that one could buy such things in certain bookstores, so I bought what I thought would be appropriate for an audition. I bought a True Confessions magazine, and I memorized two or three paragraphs of this of one of the stories in this thing. I didn't know any better. So I got up on the stage and I'm reading this thing, and I was hardly through the first paragraph when they stopped me. Oh, my God, just thinking about it.
So it's amazing, really, that you were able to actually get a part after all of this. Just tell me, what was the thing that you did that you think convinced the right people at the theater company to give you a shot?
They They didn't give me a shot. They rejected me after they saw my audition. And I made some observations myself while I was there. At, mind you, this now, to put you in proper focus, the first place I went to when I was given the first audition and the guy threw me out, it was the American Negro Theater, and it was located on 135th Street near Lenox Avenue. They were in the process, I had no knowledge of this, of course, they were in the process of moving to a much larger space on 127th Street, and that's where I went for this for the second audition. And they had a larger stage, and they had a wonderful auditorium, and they had many seats. I think the first place on 135th Street had probably 40 seats, 45 seats, maybe 50. This new place had at least, they could hold at least 150, 200 people. Anyway, I noticed that they did not have a janitor there. So when they rejected me the first time, after licking my wounds for a while, I went back a few days later and I proposed to them, since they didn't have, and it appeared, as it appeared to me, a janitor, I would do the janitor work, which I perceived as being not a great deal of work, because I would just maybe mop the stage down from time to time and do the sweep up and get the garbage out, which I could do in a half hour or so, or maybe an hour. And I proposed that I would do the cleaning up stuff if they would let me come and study. And the people to whom I was speaking, they were the administrators of the American Negro Theater at that time. And they were somehow impressed with my determination. And they said, if you want to study that badly, you can come in. And so they took me in, and I was the janitor.
My guest is Sidney Poitier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sidney Poitier. His memoir, The Measure of a Man, has just been published in paperback. Let me advance the story a little further and take you to the early part of your movie career, specifically to Blackboard Jungle, which was released in 1954. This was an important film for you. You had one of the leads in it. This is the most famous high school film, I think. It opens with Rock Around the Clock. Glenn Ford plays the new teacher at a school just filled with juvenile delinquents. And in your first scene, he catches you and some of the other guys smoking in the bathroom. You're washing your hands with your back turned toward the teacher for most of this scene. Let's hear this scene.
What's your name, wise guy?
Me? Miller. Gregory Miller. You want me to spell it out for you so you won't forget it?
You don't have to do that. I'll remember, Miller.
Sure, Chief, you do that.
Or maybe you'd like to take a walk down to the principal's office right now with me. Is that what you want?
You holding all the cards, Chief. You want to take me to see Mr. Warnicke? You do just that.
Who's your home period teacher?
You are, Chief.
Well, why aren't you with the rest of the class?
I already told you. Came in to wash up, Chief.
All right, then wash up. Just cut out that Chief routine, you understand?
Sure, Chief. That's what I've been doing all the time. Okay for us to drift now, Chief?
I want to catch you in here again.
Suppose I got business here, Chief.
Look, how many times do I have to tell you? Let's go, huh? Come on, let's go.
Sidney Poitier, how did you like your role in Blackboard Jungle?
I liked it. I liked it. This young guy that I played, he was really on the cusp of finding himself in useful ways or losing himself to forces he couldn't quite understand by then. And so he had some complications, he had some complexities, he had some depth to him. And I liked playing him.
Well, you became the African-American leading man in the 60s. What were some of the things that you felt you weren't allowed to play or express as an African-American leading man in the 60s in Hollywood?
That is a very good question, and the true answer is I have no such imagery of what I was not able to express, because taking the times as they were, the fact of my career was in itself remarkable.
Right.
Just the fact of it, you see. It would have been a luxury I would not have spent much time on trying to determine what was missing. What was missing was not so much for me, but what was missing for the overwhelming majority of other minority actors at the time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. What were some of the things you heard from your fellow actors at the time about stereotype roles that they had to play in Hollywood when you came to Hollywood?
Yeah, well, you know, most of us, I think, were obliged to play what was available. I did not take advantage of that. I couldn't. It was not what I needed to do for my life. I had elected to be the kind of actor whose work would stand as a representation of my values.
Let me talk with you about a scene that I think represents the kind of values that you're talking about. And this is a scene from In the Heat of the Night. In that film, Rod Steiger plays a local police chief in a southern town. You're a homicide cop from Philadelphia passing through this southern town, but you're arrested for being suspicious because you're a black man from out of town carrying money in your wallet. The police chief doesn't really believe that you're a cop, so he calls your boss in Philly. And your boss suggests that you stay in this small southern town to help them solve this big murder case that they're working on, because they don't have cops who are nearly as experienced as you are. So in this scene, you and Rod Steiger, who's still very skeptical of you, go to question one of the leading white businessmen in town. And I'll just explain, in case it's confusing as our listeners hear it, that as you're questioning him, the businessman slaps you, and then without missing a beat, you slap him right back. Here's the scene.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert, might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Sidney Poitier, in your new memoir, you say that's not the way the scene was originally written. Originally, you didn't slap this businessman right after he slapped you. What did you do in the original scene, and why did you want to change it?
The original scene called for the businessman to slap me and for me to absorb it and leave. I found it reprehensible that the writers writing for that period would not have written it differently. And I felt that the natural emotional response to being slapped, as, and I'm speaking not as Sidney Poitier, but I'm speaking as a Philadelphia detective, that the natural response to a man slapping him, he's going to slap him right back. And I elected as an actor to do that, because were I the guy from Philadelphia who was slapped, I would slap the guy right back. And I thought that that would be, since those kinds of moments were never found in American films from the inception of films in this country, that kind of a scene, which would be electrifying on the screen, was always either avoided, not thought of, and I insisted that if they wished my participation in the film, that they would have to rewrite it to exemplify that. They were, meaning the director, Norman Jewison, who was and is an exquisite artist, and the producer, Walter Mirisch, who is, I mean, his record is fabulous, and we've been very good friends all these years. Both of them said, hey, that's great. Let's do it that way. So we did it. And it indeed did turn out to be a highlight moment in that film. But it also spoke not just of the two characters. It spoke of our time. It spoke of the time in America when in films, at least, we could step up to certain realities.
In that film, you use something that you've used in a lot of your films, a very indignant stare, a stare that carries a lot of weight. Can you talk a little about how you perfected that look?
I didn't perfect that look. That look first of all, I don't acknowledge that I have such a look. I
mean, right, right.
Because I see myself differently than other people see me, obviously.
Right. But is that, do you think, a look that came from real life or one that you just developed for your acting roles?
No, my acting roles are at the core of themselves a part of me. So whatever that look is, I mean, I cannot manufacture such a look. It comes out of those forces that are churning internally in the individual, you know? And I just have that look, I suppose, even when I'm thinking of things that are quite contrary to what the look might suggest.
Mm-hmm.
I just have that look, and I'm sorry if I've put people off with it.
Oh, not at all. No, I mean, it's a great look, and it's certainly the one you need in the roles that you use it in. So, no. Sidney Poitier, in the minute that we have remaining, I'm wondering why we don't get to see you much in movies anymore.
Listen, my darling lady, I'm 73 years old. I have been working in films for 51 years, and I've made a great number of movies. And there are other areas of my life now that the most important currency I own is my time. And I need to spend it now with a great deal of care, you know, for obvious reasons. And I just simply don't have the time to go over ground I've covered. At least I don't want to spend the remaining time I have in this life of mine doing things that I've done before.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to begrudge you that. We just miss you in the movies.
Oh, that's very kind of you, and I thank you for that.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sidney Poitier recorded last year. His memoir, The Measure of a Man, has just been published in paperback.
In the heat of the night, seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah. In the heat of night, I'm feeling motherless somehow. Stars with evil eyes stare from the skies, all mean and bright. Ain't a woman yet been born. Knows how to make the morn come.
when I had to sell my soul for just a little light
in the heat of the night.
In the heat of the night.
Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, The Score. This is Fresh Air. Robert De Niro, Marlon Brando, and Edward Norton star in the new heist film, The Score, directed by Frank Oz. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Years ago, the idea of Robert De Niro and Marlon Brando appearing in the same movie together would have been electrifying news. Just the very announcement of such a project might have started lines forming in front of theaters everywhere, from New York's Upper West Side to the shores of Santa Monica. That, of course, was before De Niro started appearing in a different piece of commercial trivia every 6 months, and Brando became the weird hermit of the Hollywood Hills. Older viewers may think of De Niro and Brando as actors who worked with Bernardo Bertolucci, Elia Kazan, Martin Scorsese, and Francis Coppola. But for today's younger audiences, De Niro is the arson cop in Backdraft, and Brando is nobody. It wouldn't be outrageous to imagine the two finally getting together in, say, Scary Movie 3. The relief is that The Score is an okay, relatively adult movie. Making his first non-comedy, director Frank Oz displays a solid mastery of suspense and a good eye for fresh locations. The movie's screenplay, which boasts three writers, grade B dialogue, and cliched situations, is terrible. But by this time, commenting on the shortcomings of Hollywood scripts is a bit like making observations on the rain in Seattle. So what else is new? To say De Niro and Brando are co-stars overstates the case. De Niro, who plays a veteran safecracker based in Montreal named Nick, is really paired up with Edward Norton. His character, a punkish burglar of uncertain pedigree named Jack, teams up with Nick to rob the Montreal Customs House. Brando plays an aging fence who sets up the job and plans to dispose of the booty, a 17th century jeweled scepter, but otherwise stays in the background. The De Niro-Brando relationship turns out to be enjoyably, if a bit eerily, reminiscent of those between Humphrey Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet in a variety of Warner Brothers thrillers from the 1940s. The comparison is doubly or triply apt because of Brando's enormous girth, whose circumference is truly Greenstreet-like in its proportions. In this scene, which could be taking place in a Casablanca coffee house, but which actually unfolds in a jazz club De Niro's character owns, the two argue over how to divide up the swag.
All right, I'm gonna do it.
Good, good. Sweetheart. You're a sweetheart. Bravo. Making sense.
Look, because of the risk involved, my end's gotta be $6 million.
Operator, I got a nut down here that says just at $6 million. No, it's not paramedics, I think. You all right?
I'm fine.
$6 million? What happened to four?
I'm doing it in my backyard. I'm not going to go like that. I'm sorry. If you want me to do this, you got to pay me what's right. It's got to be that way.
I always pay you what's right.
You always think you pay me what's right. I always know when you pay me. It's not always right. I need this for this.
I like your style.
As entertaining as these occasional sideshows are, the main action unfolds between De Niro and Norton, an acting matchup that promises much but delivers little. Norton has been famous for his expertise since his debut as a city-billy murder suspect in Primal Fear, where he stole all his scenes with Richard Gere. Unfortunately, the ease with which Norton shifts characterizations has made him more a gifted mimic than a true translator of human feeling. Here, his character Jack masquerades as a mentally retarded janitor so he can get an inside job at the customs house. Jack's impersonation is impeccable, if all surface, but the same can be said of Norton's performance as Jack. It's technically proficient, but heartless. Norton is very much the male version of another talented but cold actor, Gwyneth Paltrow. Director Oz takes what he's handed and makes the very best out of it. Montreal is a rarely used backdrop, and Oz makes full use of it, from the streets of its picturesque old city to the sewers underneath. But he's a director, not a surgeon, and he can't implant a heart into an android's body. It's funny to think that when De Niro and Brando finally teamed up for a movie, that its problem would be a lack of feeling.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Discovery Channel, presenting When Dinosaurs Roamed America. New dinosaur discoveries premiering Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the grandson of Jimmy McHugh, the composer of I Can't Give You Anything But Love, On the Sunny Side of the Street, and I'm in the Mood for Love. Also, actor Vince Vaughn talks about his new movie, Made. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.